back. Yeah, we can meet whereabouts. There should be a cafe around here somewhere.
Welcome to the Tradie HQ podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Tradie HQ, Australia's first co-working and business incubator aimed specifically at trade-based businesses.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Tradie HQ podcast. This is Dan, and today we're departing from the usual program whereby I would interview someone else, and I've been lucky enough to get Nick from the Mill Gym, who's now the most return person of the podcast to date. Back when I first interviewed Nick for our second podcast, he made the offer afterwards to interview me so that I could get the story out for Tradie HQ, and now that I've secured a property for Tradie HQ, I thought it was a good opportunity to take him up on that offer and have my chance to explain my background. So thanks, Nick. Thanks.
No worries. Yep, no worries at all. Tables have turned, hey?
They have.
I just thought at the time when we did the first podcast, I thought it was a good idea to actually get your side of it, because whenever you start a new initiative or whenever you're trying to drive a new business, it's always good to know the sort of person that's behind it. So, for example, if you're starting the Tradie HQ thing, the whole thing, there's someone behind it, and people essentially want to know what the story is behind that brand. So I thought it was a good idea, basically, to now turn the tables and see what you're about, and pretty much ask you the same questions that you asked me.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I will admit to being more nervous for this one than I have been for any of the other ones. So
I'll be gentle, mate.
No worries. All right, mate. Well, over to you then.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for this. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. Firstly, where all podcasts start, especially when we're looking at the interviewee in terms of where they've come from, what they're doing, what's your background, and where did you start? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, okay. So I'm Perth born and bred. Grew up in the northern suburb called Kingsley, which back when we moved there, it was that was the end of the freeway. So that was at Hepburn Ave. We spent my brother and I've got a younger brother, 2 years younger. He and I spent our childhood basically running around in what's now sort of the Padbury and that sort of thing, which is all sand, you know, yeah, right the way through. So grew up in Kingsley, went to school and high school through there, got towards the end of high school and sort of couldn't think of what I wanted to do in terms of a career. I had a dream to be a knife maker. That was
right. Yeah, cool.
That didn't go down too well at the dinner table in terms of a secure career. But past that, my dad had always been in the Army Reserve, and at that point I think he would have been a warrant officer at 16 Battalion in Karakata. And so I'd always grown up, you know, at the sergeant's mess and, you know, all these different family fun days and everything they'd have out at Karakata. And so I'd always been around the military, and I'd always sort of seen, you know, the position dad held in the military. And so, I don't know, one day at this stage I had sort of hair down to my shoulders and, right, and that sort of thing. And I was working at the Sereno Key dive shop, and I just said to mum and dad, I said, I think I want to join the army. And it came a bit from left field, and they said, okay, well... And that was that, really. They supported that. And at the time, a good mate of dad's, and I believe a friend of yours, Tony Wills.
Yep.
Yeah, from the regiment. Right. So he and dad were good friends, and so Tony was in recruiting at the time. So we sort of, you know, they say it's not what you know, it's who you know. Yeah. And Tony got us in and
fast tracked.
Yeah. And that was that. Like, so that was I joined. So that process started when I was sort of 16 and 9 months, and then so when did I join? I joined in March 1998. And right. I was born in November, so yeah, I was literally 17 in a few months, and over to Kapooka.
Wow, straight up.
Straight away, yeah. And so from there, back then you couldn't corps enlist, so it was basically you went there, and while you're at Kapooka, they used the psych evaluations in your platoon to say, righto, he's going here, he's going there, and that was it. And so, given that my dad was infantry, I had wanted to go to infantry.
Yeah.
But we just didn't have the spots available for our platoon.
Yeah.
And then so my sort of psych results were fairly good, and so which ended up putting me in the like sort of middle of the road and got sent to ordnance.
Right. Okay. So how'd you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't obviously there's a drastic difference between infantry and ordnance.
Yeah.
But you know, it was what it was. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things. If it's not, there was no point in complaining. It was just right. We'll do that. And once I get there, if I do want a core transfer, then that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So
is that what you, when you heard the word ordnance, when they said that to you, what was your initial feeling about it?
Well, I mean, back then I didn't really know much better.
Right.
You know,
okay.
the only experience, or I guess the judgments that I could make back then were based on the platoon staff that we had who were ordnance.
Right.
And there and then I couldn't see a great deal of difference, yep. you know, between yep. one platoon staff to the next.
Yep.
Obviously, that changed a bit when we went to our IETs.
Yeah, so a bit of a different IET.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, the irony being that, you know, I joined the Army because I didn't want to necessarily do any more study. Yep. And then the IET for ordnance is basically you sitting in a classroom.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, we were fortunate to a degree in that the trade that I went into was as a yardsman sort of thing. So there was a bit more sort of out there sort of on the machinery and forklifts yeah. and stuff like that. But, yeah, it was still predominantly classroom.
So for those who don't know, what are the duties of the Ordnance Corps?
So, I mean, the Ordnance Corps encompasses back then it encompassed a fairly wide range of services within the Army, and it ranged from clerical, so you know, the admin clerks on basically like a front desk administrator, through to the Q store, which in the Army is the place where you go to pick up your uniforms and other bits and pieces. And then I guess in a supply chain, the next step sort of up from there, or in a broader sense, is a warehouse. It's a warehouse, yep. and that's basically where the yardsmen or the operator suppliers, as they were known back then, they run that. So then they supply the Q store, who supply the soldiers. So that's where we were. So I guess sort of obviously the rear echelon in terms of when you go out field and that sort of thing, transporting stuff like food, water, ammunition, petroleum and that sort of stuff.
Everything that the every other unit needs, especially the infantry, especially the fighting units, you're there to give them what they need, basically.
Yeah, that's it. And it's, you know, there is a stigma attached with being ordnance, but, you know, I soon realised that, especially, I mean, my first posting was up to Townsville, which, you know, is an operational force up there.
Yep.
And so straight away, you know, as soon as we got there, we were straight out field.
Yep.
You know, by the time I was 18, we're in Timor on the first trip, you know, and because we usually got attached to infantry battalions, you know, we were still going out field and you know, with our packs on our backs and that sort of thing. So
still getting out and about.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, because I remember when I, 96, I elected to go infantry and was lucky enough to get it. There was obviously enough slots at that time.
Yep.
But, yeah, I because I had no, there was nothing outside of infantry for me. So I was very, very lucky and grateful that I actually got it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as I went through the next subsequent 12 years, I realised that actually we're a small piece of this puzzle. Infantry, we won't have bombs, we won't have ammunition, we wouldn't have feed, we wouldn't have anything like this if it weren't for all the sporting units. And that is the Army. Essentially, it's one team, but it's a massive team.
Mm.
And that's the thought process. So if there is a stigma, I think there's always some sort of back and forth going in between the units and the different corps, and that's part of what makes the environment sometimes fun, sometimes hectic, but at the same time, you know, it's all in good will, all in good humour from my perspective anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, as my sort of career progressed in the Army, you know, I've had quite a few postings. So I went Townsville, over here to the Pilbara Regiment Karratha, back to Townsville, down to Sydney, and it was that posting down in Sydney where we were part of the founding section for the Special Operations Combat Supply Services Company, SOCC as it was known back then. And that was when I sort of, you know, was my first exposure directly with Special Forces and working with guys like, you know, well, it was Four Commando back then and obviously the regiment. And it was then that I realised like the difference in maturity level,
right.
You know, when you're dealing with guys like that and obviously yourself. With your history, and that's when, you know, you're potentially looking at two vastly polar opposite levels of soldiering when you look at, you know, an ordnance soldier versus a, you know, a qualified special forces operator. But the respect that operator's got back to the ordnance or, the storeman is, is great. You know, it was really good, you know, providing that you did your job, you got them what they needed when they needed it, then, you know, it was like you're part of the team.
Yeah, I think
that was...
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, that maturity piece you spoke about, the average age of the soldiers in those units is older, but also they've got a great understanding, that maturity to understand that they're not the... You know, we're not... It doesn't stop with us. We need to have the support of all these units, and we need to have to make sure that in order for us to operate at our level, every other unit recognises that they need to support us as best they can.
Mm.
So, it is definitely... And I notice the difference when I go back to infantry battalions. I see the difference in age groups and approaches and that, and it's good that it was that tangible to you as a young soldier back then.
Yeah. No, it was. It was definitely...
So was this about 2004, 2005? When was this?
Because that's when I... So previously, like, in Townsville, I'd been to East Timor back in 99.
Yep.
And then so my next deployment was Afghanistan in 2006, and I'd already been there for a year. So, yeah, it would have been 2005, right. 2006.
Right. How was Timor?
Yeah, Timor was... Well, I mean, I was only 18. I had my 19th birthday over there. So, yeah, cool. And given that it was the first push in, it was... It was different, you know. It was just coming from, you know, an army, and I'd only been in the army for a shorter period of time at that stage, but, you know, there was never, even when I first started, there was no operational tempo. You know, some of the guys had been to Bougainville and some of the older guys, Rwanda and Somalia and that sort of thing, but, you know, as soon as East Timor started ramping up, no one knew what was going on, you know. We were there sort of preparing flak jackets from Vietnam and that sort of thing and issuing them out.
Yeah.
So to get on the ground and all of a sudden have this just a completely different operating environment, you know. Yeah. It went from, you know, being stuck in barracks and people concerned about whether your pants were bloused or not to, like, literally a more of a task-focused situation. Yeah. And that was what I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And subsequently, as I say, with my experience and working with you guys in the past, that was the thing that I really liked as well, the fact that, like, well, this is the job we've got to do.
Yeah.
Let's just get it done, you know. Let's get rid of any of the extraneous and superfluous silly stuff that shouldn't concern us. Yeah. This is what we need to do. So,
And inevitably, when you get back to barracks life, that stuff comes back into the picture. But, I should imagine for you guys it would have been fairly expeditionary because there was no infrastructure set up for you guys for the force element or for the contingent that went over in the first place. So a lot of that would have been down to you guys and the engineers and setting up comms and all those sorts of things, let alone the infantry soldiers doing the patrols and security elements. So, that would have been a pretty exciting time for an 18-year-old, for sure.
Yeah, it was. It was an eye-opener, for sure. And it's, you know, but even then, you just... I knew no better, you know, so it was literally, this is what we're doing.
Yep.
You know, and we had... Fortunately, at that stage, had some really good leaders in terms of our sort of higher rank, like senior NCOs and that sort of thing, who had that same mindset. And because we were the part of the expeditionary sort of force, it was a while before, you know, higher sort of ranking officers came down and started trying to impose those sort of
big army things.
Yeah. So, you know, when we were on the airfield to start with, and, you know, sleeping on the ground and all that sort of stuff, and still going out and doing clearing patrols.
Yep.
You know, that was awesome. You know, because we're actually doing a clearing patrol.
Yeah.
It's not just a thing that, you know, stops you from sleeping.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And you're keen to do it.
Yeah. And there's an actual purpose, you know, because you think, well, there actually might be someone out here that wants to hurt us. You know, so your vigilance and your attention is right up there. So
yeah, okay. And so when you went back, you obviously came back to Australia, and then you were posted to a couple of different units. Your next deployment was about 2005, 2006, did you say?
2006, yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, that was good. It was a lot different to Timor.
Yeah, for sure.
Because obviously between Timor and then we'd had, the first push into Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then we were SOTG-3, so there'd already been two previous rotations before us. So once we got to Camp Russell, it was established, you know. It was literally like being ultimately posted to a new unit within Australia almost, apart from the HESCO and everything else that was there.
Yeah.
But it was already formed. But again, you know, again, this deployment was as a part of the SOTG. So, you know, we had SAS, OC and RSM, SSM, I should say.
Yep.
And so the whole organisation, again, just went back to being that task-focused situation. And it was, you know... Just do your job.
Yeah.
It's not, we don't ask anything else.
Yeah.
Do your job, do it well, and, you know, things will be easy.
And I guess it'd be much better having everything set up when you get there. So you just basically slot in, put your bag in, you got your cot, and get on with work.
That's it. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was hard. I mean, I was fortunate enough while we were over there to be one of the guys. We went out on Op Perth, so I was driving an up armored Unimog. And for those listening who aren't familiar with that, Unimog's like a big Mercedes-Benz truck that the army use, and up armored means that it had, you know, reinforced walls and windows to make it bulletproof. And ultimately, belly, yeah. Unfortunate thing about it is you had no way of getting out of it. You actually didn't have any opportunity to return fire because the canopy had been closed off and everything like that. So I was rolling around in one of two of these up armored Unimogs with, at any given time, you know, X amount of high explosives, ammunition, fuel, water, everything in the back of it. So that was an awesome experience, and it was unique for me to be on that patrol as an ordnance soldier. Yep. You know, because even then, I mean, I was attached to the Q store then, and we had sort of, you know, other infantry soldiers who were Q store allocated.
Yeah.
And I got the spot in front of them, which was
sweet.
It put people's nose out of joint, but it just came back to that whole thing we said about, you know, do your job and stuff will work out. And, I just did my job tirelessly, never complained, you know, and just got on with it. And obviously, and that didn't go unnoticed and meant that that I got the Guernsey when that came up.
Yeah, great. And what were the drivers for you? Like, if you said that, okay, yeah, I'm just going to do my job. Obviously, that's not unique, but it's definitely not the majority of people, because the army's a slice of the civilian demographic, effectively. So you get people from all sorts of walks of life. They join the army, but what was it that you thought made you different in order to put yourself in a position for going out outside the wire like that?
So I can probably attribute this back to an experience that I had in my first posting back in Townsville. So as a it would have been post East Timor. We got back and there was sort of expression of interest went out for those who wanted to be a part of the battalion obstacle course team.
Right.
And I was young and fit, and I thought, yeah, no, I'll do that. And I won't lie, part of my motivation for that was because we were doing training during work hours. Yeah, so it was an extra bit of PT that we could slot in. And the RSM was running the team, a guy by the name of Speedy Schubert, who was a really great leader and a great RSM.
Yeah.
Underneath him was Richie Gibson, who was the battalion PTI. And then we had our subunit PTI, Glenn Azar, Alyssa's dad.
Yeah.
And so with those three sort of above us, again, it came down to the RSM just wanted an ordnance battalion or a support battalion to win the brigade obstacle course, you know. And that's that inter-unit core rivalry, you know. So it would be really unusual for an ordnance or a supply battalion to win over, you know, 1RR, 2RR, 4-field, 3/4 cav and all those other arms units. So that was his motivation. And basically, with that in mind, he said, you know, Richie, Glenn, make it happen. And so we, you know.
Trained.
Yeah, yeah. And we just saw it, you know. And literally there was no rank at that point. You know, we were calling the RSM mate.
Yep.
He was cheering us on, and it was just it was a really good environment to be in. So, and I would say that point there sort of changed my outlook on soldiering.
Yeah,
up to that point, it was a very sort of, you know, within the day-to-day job, it was very dictatorial, and, you know, there was no connect between sort of, you know, a couple of ranks up from a private. You know, we just thought that they were just out to fuck us around, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So to be working with these guys, it was great. And so that sort of that was my first introduction to really good leadership within the army. And but what else it did is, by virtue of them being good leaders and having our interests at heart, it made us want to do the right thing by them and impress them. And, you know, we looked up to them they got that respect organically. It wasn't respect because
of his rank.
Correct, just wanted to make them proud.
Yeah.
And I sort of carried that through, you know, and it's the whole thing of, like, work hard, play hard sort of thing, you know. Like, I would always do my best at PT and everything like that. And so when it came to Afghanistan and being there amongst a bunch of highly skilled and trained operators across the board, whether it was the door kickers or, you know, through to even the Q staff and then and everyone else.
Yeah.
I just did my best, you know. I never made anything hard. If someone asked us to do something, then we'd do it, you know. And that might be a rations break at 3 a.m. because, you know, we need to do a re-sup to one of the patrols that are out there, you know.
Yep.
And I always found it strange that there were people that were pushing back on that. But, you know, again, that's why we were there. Yeah. Everyone had a job. And so obviously that sort of thing didn't go unnoticed. And when it came to the point of like, well, who are we going to take outside the wire? Are we going to take this person here who has done nothing but complain? Or are we going to take Dan, who has done everything we've asked him since, you know, has shown an interest in what we do and trying to better himself.
Yep.
And that's what happened.
It's good that you saw that as a reward too, you know. Some people think that's the last thing I want to do, you know, yeah. Step outside the wire, especially with what's going on. At what time of year was that? Up Perth,
yeah. So it was summer. Yeah. It was so, pretty full on.
Yeah, interesting time to be over there as well, especially in your position from the outside. Not necessarily the outside looking in, but more or less you'll be able to see how things roll and see how that environment is very much merit-based and the mutual respect gained by not letting rank. Rank always had a presence and always had a structure which would need to be adhered to, but is very much merit-based in terms of, yeah, if I put the work in and I prove myself to be worthy of the job, then 9 times out of 10, I'll get the Guernsey.
Mm.
And that's a elite environment, effectively. And we don't rest on our rank. We don't rest on our laurels. We're only as good as our last gig. And as long as our last gig is one where we put all our effort in, then sweet, we're in. And if people around us like that, it's a very, very nice environment to work in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you came back from that deployment. Were you inspired to stay in the Army and continue, or what was the next step for you?
So we came back from there and I spent – actually, there's a good story about that. So I came back and so that would have been my last. So I came back at the beginning of 2007 and that would have been my last year in that unit before I got posted out. And I think I'd already received my posting order, maybe got that while I was overseas, I think, right. And that was to Cairns, to 51 FNQR in Cairns.
Right.
Could
be worse.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was posting on promotion as well. So right, I was corporal at the time, posted on promotion to sergeant up to Cairns. And in the time, so I had obviously come back from overseas, you back into the unit and that sort of thing. Went on leave, came back, and during this, so back in 2004, I did my first unit adventurous training leaders course. So for those that don't know, which is probably most of the listeners, is in the Army there's a thing they call adventurous training. And the idea behind adventurous training is to put soldiers in a situation whereby they're outside of their comfort zone. And a term that's thrown around is battlefield inoculation. And the idea being that when we're in a peacetime era of the Defence Force, the best way for us to prepare soldiers mentally for the experiences physiologically or psychologically they'll have on the battlefield is to put them in situations where they need to cope with it. And so the first, I've been a rock climber since I was sort of 13, and the first course I went on was rock climbing as a UATL, lead climbing. So spent all the time down in the Grampians and Mount Arapiles and that sort of thing, and really enjoyed that again because it's almost a rank-free scenario, yeah, whereby your task is to run a safe and effective adventure training activity, you know, and yeah, it's rank neutral because you don't want a warrant officer who's, you know, a senior soldier in the Army to feel as though he has to do something because of his rank, you know, to yeah, save face in front of his subordinates. So it's rank neutral so that they get the most out of it at an individual level. But again, that just reinforced being an outcome-based
yeah,
activity that, you know, it is a merit-based thing. So what that led to, obviously, was my interest in all things roping and adventure-based for the Army. And my unit that I was posted to at the time was at the base of the Blue Mountains in New South Wales. And so one weekend, it was a Sunday, I'd gathered two other soldiers from the unit, two of the private truck drivers, and I said, "Hey, guys, do you want to go canyoning?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, what's that?" I said, "Well, it's basically you start at the top of a water feature and you abseil and make your way down to the bottom and then you walk out. That simple." It's like, "Oh, okay, no worries. What are we doing?" And I said, "Oh, we're going to do Claustral Canyon." And so for anyone who's got an idea of Claustral Canyon, it's in the guidebook, it's, you know, it's hard. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a long day. And, of course, being soldiers, when it said, you know, you need a wetsuit, you need all this other stuff, we're like, that's for civvies. Like, hard can it be? So we did the canyon. Long story short, because this could go on, we missed the exit point and so continued down until it was dark and realised that we're not going to get out. So made the call to the boys who were tired, cold and hungry at this stage. Yeah. I said, look, guys, let's start finding some shelter and some stuff for a fire because we're going to spend the night here. So we did that. And so this took us into Monday. And ultimately we got rescued. Helicopter came in.
Okay.
The guys, I'd left my two guys, again, so many lessons learned from this, but I'd left the two guys to try and find a way out. So I knew that another ravine came in further on down and that it was a walk-in, walk-out canyon. And I thought, if I can get down to there, I'll be able to walk out, find some high ground and get some mobile phone coverage and raise the alarm.
Yeah.
So I did that, went up what I thought was this canyon. Turns out it wasn't. And I got to this point, it just cornered me in and it was a chimney, which is, you know, like a narrow rock fissure that you need to get out of. So I end up soloing this 10 or 12 metre chimney, got to the top, got some phone reception and found out that they'd already put a helicopter in the air and they'd winched the other two guys out.
Oh, right, okay.
So then they came to get me. And hot tip for young players, if you're doing anything that you think might require some form of rescue, don't wear cam pants and a black singlet. Because against the landscape, it's hard for the helicopter to find you. But they finally did, and we got out. And when I got back to the unit, we were summoned and charged for AWOL.
For the Monday. Oh, wow. That's big army, eh?
That is. And the only thing that saved me, well, not the only thing that saved me, so we got charged. Or we were facing a charge. We got charged, and not long after that, we were at a function, and General Hindmarsh was there.
Right.
From X regiment, and me and my other two mates were sitting there talking, and he came over and said, "Oh, hey guys, how you going?" I said, "Oh yeah, no, good sir, good." He goes, "What's going on?" And you could obviously see that we're having a bit of an in-depth conversation. We said, "Oh, just having a chat, sir." We
about our oncoming charge.
Yeah, basically yeah. That's what we said. And he said, "Oh, what do you mean?" And we explained it to him and said what we were doing and all that sort of stuff. And he said, "Oh, all right, no, leave it with me."
Yeah, sweet.
Yeah, and so we did get charged. However, after his interdiction, it got quashed on review.
Okay, yeah.
Which is the right thing to do, you know. Yep. Like, it was, at the end of the day, we learnt so much out of it. Yep. And it was just an indication to me that, you know, it doesn't matter what posting you're at. Like, sometimes there's people there that just lose sight of the bigger picture because they're sticklers for the rules. And
yeah, well, what would you say? So I think you stated at the start, the intent of the adventure training cell was basically to run safe events so we could inoculate effectively people against the fear and the anxiety that comes potentially with operations. So if that's the intent, you were basically doing that activity with that intent within that theme, and it's within the remit of the adventurous activities the Army does and within your skill set as a climber. It was down climbing, but at the same time, still climbing. Yeah. Still gear, same gear. But then not everyone's on line with that, with the intent. Not everyone's line with the themes of that. And that's wherever you go, I guess you've probably found that out in the civvy street as well, in terms of outside the Army, that not everyone's going to be seeing these things from the same perspective that you're seeing. And
No, that's it. And it's, you know, even now, it's something that me and those two guys have got together as well. You know, it was a bond. Yeah, and, you know, we spoke about it last time when Danny was here about, you know, the bond that happens when you share hardship. Yeah. So that was my farewell basically from that unit.
Right.
And so then I marched into 51 FNQR up in Cairns, which is one of the regional force surveillance units. So it's in charge along with sort of North Force and the Pilbara Regiment from sort of patrolling the top end. And again, it was, you know, it's an infantry unit, but it's a specialised infantry unit. So there was, that was an amazing experience as well. You know, we spent a lot of our time on Thursday Island and all around, you know, the Cape, couple of Cape trips, couple of combined forces exercises out of like Normanton and some of the remote Aboriginal communities up there.
Yeah, you got to see some stuff that not many people see, which is cool, and do some stuff that not many people see. And did you continue with the adventure climbing or adventure activities?
Yeah, so I mean that was a big part of I realised, you know, although I was ordnance, you know, and the stigma that went with that and that sort of thing in the regular Army, I'd found this avenue to be able to pursue something that I really enjoyed, and that was adventure training.
Yeah,
you know, and so I think about the last, so after Cairns, I got posted down to the 5th Aviation Regiment in Townsville. And again, aviation being a specialised core, the people there, again, are very outcome-based. You know, you're talking about keeping airframes in the sky. It doesn't really matter, again. Yes, dress and bearing comes into it, but it's not. We're not going to sacrifice the effectiveness of our unit for the sake of, you know, making sure the guys have got their pants bloused or whatever. Yeah. So it was, a really relaxed but professional atmosphere. And fortunately, my OC, or officer commanding, was also an adventure training qualified officer. And so we had, in that unit, we had UATLs for all of the disciplines in adventure training. So, you know, we went and did whitewater rafting on the... I can't remember the name of the river now, that runs right through sort of northern Queensland. That was a four-day expedition on rafts. We took the whole unit down to Mount Arapiles and spent 2 weeks down there. Yeah, so, sweet. You know, my last 12 months in the Army, probably 3 or 4 months of that was spent running adventure training.
Right, okay.
So it was, it was something that I really, really enjoyed and really pursued. And it's something that I attribute being a massive aid in developing my leadership and identifying sort of, I mean, the Army in general, the Defence Force in general is really good for developing leadership skills because you get exposed to really good, really bad, you know, in between. And I took the opinion back then, even back when I was doing that obstacle course with Glenn and the guys, I thought, I really want to aspire to be like these guys. What is it that's making me want to be like them? You know, it's respect. It's respecting your subordinates. It's making sure that the right person is put in the right task. You know, if you think about an obstacle course, you've got, you know, other stuff you've got to get through, the machine gun and that sort of thing. And there's no point in giving the machine gun to the smallest guy, you know, just because he's the smallest guy. Like, give it to the guy who's more capable of carrying it.
So you had the opportunity to see good and bad, but you also had the opportunity to exercise the lessons, I guess, because normally we'd have people operating under you, especially as you raise higher in rank. And as a sergeant, I guess you'd be more involved in the day-to-day with the people under you as well. So there's an opportunity to put those lessons into practice, which is great, which is the Army, once again, is very, very good at. And so that was your last year. Was 5AV still providing airframes and pilots to Tag East or Tag West?
I think it was One Aviation had relocated to Holsworthy then.
And then, so last year, and then what were you thinking before you got out? What was the plan?
Yeah, so funnily enough, I won't go too deep into this story, but I had bought a hair salon in Cairns while I was there, and so I was sort of running that remotely.
There's so many people going to ask questions about that. My head's just going a million miles an hour. Or why? But but at the end of the day, you know, business is business as well. You know, if you see an opportunity. And that doesn't matter what it is, as an entrepreneur, you were going to exercise that opportunity. So, yeah, I'll let you explain your way. Yourself out of that one.
It was an opportunity, and it was definitely something that I learned lessons from.
Right.
And I can explain that to you off air. but it also, fast forwarding a little bit, it also gave me a great material for a first date with my now wife, Marta. So,
yeah, great. Here we go.
Win. So in Townsville, was running it remotely. That sort of became too hard, and I sold that business. And then I'd had enough of the Army at that point. Reason being is that, you know, after having a bit of a taste of being in the business world, I realised that, and the Army had made it a bit hard for me because I really wanted to go back to Cairns, obviously. But they just said, no, you can't. There's no way you can do it. Whatever. So... then I realised, well, at the end of the day, so at that point I was, that was in 2008, so I was 27, turning 28, and I thought, well, I'm not going to be anything that the Army doesn't want me to be, you know, so I'd rather be in control of my own destiny. And I spoke to my parents and said, look, I'm going to get out, and they said, well, what are you going to do? I said, well, I was going to move back up to Cairns, but that's not going to happen. I've sold that, and so I'm probably going to move back to Perth, and I wouldn't mind doing my electrical apprenticeship. And Dad had his own electrical contracting business at that stage, and so he spoke to his business partner and said, "Yeah, no worries, come back. We'll put you on." So that was it. So left the Army, moved back to Perth, back here to Perth in 2008. Started my mature age apprenticeship. And so, you know, at that point, Dad's company probably had about 15 to 20 employees. And it was something, I guess, I had to prepare myself for. So I went into it, and I was, of course, Dad was, you know, sitting up in his office. He wasn't part of the sort of day-to-day running. He had managers and that sort of thing to do that. And I didn't want to go into this role as the boss's son.
Yeah, right.
So I actually didn't tell many people, and unbeknownst to me, Dad hadn't really told many people either. So it was just me, just a new mature age apprentice. It wasn't a challenge for me because I was aware of what I was getting into. But, you know, you're going from the military, getting out as a sergeant and coming back to being a first-year apprentice. You know, I think the first day I was, you know, sweeping and cleaning up stuff, and which I didn't have a drama with.
Yeah.
But probably 3 months into it, that's when the guy started to realise who I was.
Right, okay.
And
Were you treated differently?
Yeah, it did change a bit. It did change a bit. And it sort of, it ostracised me to a degree because all of a sudden I'm this perceived mole of the organisation.
Okay.
And I know that there was there were a few things that went on that, you know, I know probably wouldn't have been done in front of me had people known. But on the same token, it was nothing that I was going to sort of report back to. But I know the people who perhaps took longer breaks or whatever, or turned up late, sort of afterwards, like, oh, have you told anyone about, like, no, that's all right, mate. It's not that bad.
Yep.
So that was that. Yeah, I mean, that was good. That was, and so I did my apprenticeship again, going back to TAFE with 16 to sort of 20 year olds was a bit of an eye opener. I remember probably the second day in, and we used to go once a week. So as the second week in, I was sitting there, and you know, as when you go and do any course as someone who wants to be somewhere. You have all your stuff, you know.
Yeah, the nerd.
Yeah,
that basically. Guy sitting at the front.
and it's just, you know, like the way you guys run at your camps, you know, if someone gives you a list of stuff, I just have it, you know, have it ready. Exactly. And so that's what I did, you know, had it plus other bits and pieces. And I remember one of the young kids turning around and going and looking at, you know, my desk with, you know, every coloured pen and
in order, every pointing the straight way parallel. Yeah.
He goes, can I borrow a pen? I'm like, No,
these are all spoken for. Yeah. All 10 of them.
Yeah, and he's taken aback. I'm like, mate, if you, like, you're here once a week, if you can't bring a fucking pen, like, just go. Like, I'd rather there was one less person here so I can get through this quicker. So that sort of cemented my position as the grumpy ex-AJ fucking.
But all that stood you in good stead. So would you say you would have been a better adult, older student than you would have whilst you were in school?
Yeah, I would say so. It's definitely, for me, being someone who didn't want to do any more learning once I'd finished at school, didn't want to sit in a classroom. Yeah. It's funny the way that dynamic changes once you've actually made a decision to do something and you know that the path to that achievement is doing this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did enjoy all of it. You know, doing an electrical apprenticeship was, and it's very similar to like any rope-based activity, you know, there's a lot of physics involved.
Yep.
And the cool thing about it is that you can do all this stuff on paper and use all these formulas and all the maths and then actually do it in person with, you know, measuring devices and see that what you've worked out is actually what happens.
Yeah.
And that's what I really enjoyed about it. It would have been funny, though, for my year 12 maths teacher who I used to see me saying, Miss, when am I ever going to use this in life again? Fast forward.
How did I answer that one?
Yeah, fast forward like 13 years and there I am going, oh, how do you transpose bloody equations? So
it helped, obviously, because you could visualise the end state. You knew where you were going. I guess that's a big part for a lot of kids in school. They're not being able to visualise where they're going to be at the end of it all and why they're doing it, not seeing the clear, like the golden thread effectively from where I am now to where I want to be. And having that experience and being able to see where you want to go has been pretty helpful, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of those things, and I had the experience with a couple of the guys, you know, as the apprenticeship progressed, you know, there are a couple of guys there, they're like, oh, I don't know if I really want to do this, you know, and they're like to me, you know, do you reckon you'll be an electrician when you finish this? Like, you're going to keep doing it? I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm here, mate. Like, I'm 29 years old. Like, I'm not doing this for 3 years for fucking fun. Like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing with kids, you know, and we've got that with my wife and our kids, and we're, you know, what do you think they're going to do? And I'm 100% of the belief that we need to give them enough variety and experience for them to make their own decision.
Mm.
And at the end of the day, if they're happy, then that's the biggest factor.
No matter what they do.
100%. Yeah. The last thing you want to do is sort of try and push your kid towards something, I think.
Yeah.
Because if they don't like it, it's just, you're just fighting a losing battle. You're not gonna turn a kid around who's, you know, a defiant 15 or 16 year old into doing something that you want them to do because you believe that's right.
Yeah.
They'll always succeed at something that they're enjoying. and want to do.
I think there's a lot to be said for that, you know, that the vast array of experiences and also people in their world, which they can see what good is, what bad is, see what indifferent is, all those sorts of things. And I think for me, the army was very good with that, because I was surrounded by a lot of, well, essentially father figures, people that you could look up to in terms of following a good example, or people you could see, okay, that's not necessarily the way I want to go. And when they say that it takes a village to raise a child, well, that was effectively my village, including my childhood as well, pre-army, but during the army and after the army, the people you surround yourself with. And then how that feeds into the current world is that for my daughter, the more people she gets exposed to and the more situations and the more experience she gets exposed to will fit the same thread that you've just spoken about in terms of making sure that they get to see all these things, so there's a broader range of choices and options for them, and also the confidence to know that any one of those choices, they know that, well, effectively it'll take hard work, but if I want it to happen, it'll happen. And then you just lead by example in that space.
That's it, and support them along the way.
Yeah, yep. So that's powerful. So when you finished your apprenticeship, and how'd you go? Obviously you're working for your father, but where's the next place after that? Why'd you leave the family, or what happened from there?
I did my time. I did my apprenticeship, finished that. Then during that period, we went through the GFC, The dad's company had two divisions. There was the electrical division and also the fire alarms division. Now, the fire alarms was heavily involved in the construction industry, and they had a couple of big builders go down and you know, basically decimate that side of the business. So they ended up folding that. And at that point, you know, dad was sort of approaching wanting to retire. And so him and his business partner made the decision to basically pare everything back. So we went from almost overnight. And again, this was a bit of an experience for me. Again, having, by this stage, you know, I was towards the end of my apprenticeship, it must have been like third year, and I knew what was coming. And so I'm on a job site waiting for someone to drive up and say, hey boys, tools down, come back to the office. Yeah. And so when that happened, I think a lot of the guys, they would have understood that I knew. And so then they were like, well, fuck him, you know, like, what didn't he tell us? And so that was a thing that I had to sort of get my head around.
Yeah.
So after that, they pared back the business to be just electrical, and went from, like I say, having sort of 15 guys to dad and his business partner, two tradies and me as the apprentice. So, which worked out to be really good, you know, that having a smaller team and actually getting to work with dad on a daily basis, and, you know, having a one-to-one relationship with ultimately four different tradesmen really helped my development as a tradesman. And so that was my last year. Then I stayed on for a year as a tradesman, and then started my own company, HTR Electrical. And I started that off the back of rope access. So again, when I was in the army and, you know, doing all of the roping sort of stuff, and then someone made me aware of something called IRATA, which is a rope access association. And when I got out, I thought, well, I'll go and do this course just as more of an interest thing. And then in doing the course, realised that there were no electrical contractors in Perth that did rope access. Mm. You know, there was a lot of stuff on the mine sites and that sort of thing, but no one domestically as an electrical contractor. So I started that and subcontracted to some of the guys who were doing a lot of the rope access work in the city at the time. So we did the BHP billet and sign, South 32, Rio Tinto, all that sort of stuff. So I was doing that for about a year. And then along the way, got married to my wife, Marta, and her family own the High Guys in Balcatta and Osborne Park at that stage. And her dad asked me if I would come over and help them out.
Mm.
And so I said, you know, we had a bit of a chat about it. And I said, yeah, no worries. I said, but, you know, I've started HTR Electrical. Would you mind if I kept running that on the side?
Yep.
You know, my sole focus will be on the High Guys, but if we can sort of have this in the background, then that'd be good. And he said, yeah, no worries. And we did, and it worked fine. But what happened, you know, when you're not looking for work, it tends to find you. And if jobs find you, there's a strong possibility that they're a fairly lucrative job as well. Right. And that's what was happening. So once I moved over to the high guys and started there, we started pushing a lot more into, you know, with my background in electrical, we started pushing a lot more into generators, you know, emergency supplies, events, power distribution and that sort of thing. But then what was happening is along the way I was getting other requests for work, like people asking me to do stuff, you know, whether it was rope access or any other sort of commercial industrial work. Yep. And I didn't want to pass them up, and so I spoke to a couple of other friends of mine at the time who are still friends of mine, but I spoke to them and they were working away FIFO and trying to build up their own businesses in their offswing. So we came up with this sort of arrangement where we'd each have each other's shirts. If someone was away or they couldn't get to a job, we'd put it out to the group. If someone could do it, then they'd put on that shirt and they'd go and do the job, and the client would be none the wiser. They would just assume that this company that they'd spoken to had arranged it, which was good because it gave us all that sort of impression of being bigger than what we were, and still gave us that depth of cover for jobs that came through. But what happened there was let's say a year into that, I realised that we're probably not the only three guys in Perth, electrical contractors, who have got this issue of not being able to get to work, you know, because they're doing other jobs or whatever. So I started a Facebook group called Perth One Man Band Sparkies. And the intent of that was that, you know, we'd get a whole bunch of one-man band tradies, electricians, in the same boat so that if there is a problem, then they can put it out and someone can pick it up. And then, you know, you don't say no to a job and have it go to whoever's paid the most for AdWords. Mm. So that was probably about 5 years ago, I guess, and it's just grown. And it's grown, and along the way, by virtue of me being the moderator and administrator of the group, you know, we're up to about 1,200 members now.
Wow.
Which has been curated as well.
Yeah.
Like it probably would be 4,000 if I'd let everyone in, I really want to make sure that it's just business owners and a few other key people in like the professional services sort of side.
Yep.
But what it's done is it's filled this role of providing the guys albeit an online organization where, you know, they can put jobs up, but on top of that, they can ask a question. And, you know, when you talk about a trade as broad as being an electrician, there's a lot of things that if you haven't specialised in, you know, you just don't know.
Yeah.
And there's heaps of Facebook groups for all sorts of interests that if you put a question on there, someone will shoot you down and say, well, fuck, you shouldn't even be an electrician if you don't know that.
Yeah.
You know, but no one knows everything.
Yeah.
So what I've made sure that I've promoted is that anyone can ask a question. Doesn't matter whether you think it's stupid. That, you know, that saying's around for a reason. The only stupid question is one you don't ask.
Yeah.
And if there's an electrician at your grandmother's house who doesn't know how to do something and they don't ask a question, do something unsafe, wouldn't you rather that person ask the question?
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And so by virtue of being the moderator for that group, I was getting a lot of questions from guys about running their business, you know, and saying, well, you know, I got into this because I wanted more time, freedom, more money, and I've got less of any of it. You know, and so for a few of those guys, I got them to come in and we had a bit of a chat. And what I realised, reinforced the cliche of a good tradesman isn't necessarily a good business person. In fact, most of the times they're not a good business person. And it's just because they're passionate about their trade.
Yeah.
And these guys wanted to start at their own business because that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to do what they're good at.
Yeah.
But they weren't afforded the right information from the start, which means that they either didn't set their businesses up correctly, but the biggest one is what I've now called the 2-year tax trap, which is, you know, if you decide it's relevant because we're at the beginning of the financial year now, but if you decided on the 30th of June 2020 that you were going to start business on your own as of the 1st of July, as soon as you leave that job that you were working in and start your own business, for all intents and purposes, if you start as a sole trader, the ATO think you're unemployed. You know, they don't realise that you're actually doing something for money. And the only time they'll realise that as you go on, if you're not registered for GST and if you're just, you know, doing the path of least resistance to get an ABN, is when you lodge your next tax return, which if you use an agent could be 18 months down the track.
Mm.
And so guys were, you know, propped up by the fact that they might have had a redundancy or, you know, leave and that sort of thing, and they're keen, smashing their first year, lodging their tax return, and the tax agent going, oh, okay, mate, here's your $40,000 tax bill for the year you've just worked, and here is 6 months' worth of income tax installments based on that first year's earnings. And I had, you know, there's so many guys that just had no idea that was coming. And some of them, like I say, are looking down the barrel of $60,000 tax bills, which all could have been avoided if someone had just sat down with them at the beginning and said, right, what's your plan? What's your goal?
Yeah.
And it comes back to that outcome-based sort of thing and just doing a bit of planning and saying, right, what do you want to do in 5 years? Where do you see yourself? Are you going to be doing, you know, downlights on your own for the whole time? Or do you want to have two guys working for you and, you know, or what is your lifestyle goals even?
Yeah.
And, you know, if they had had that person to sit down with them and say, this is what, then they would have set up as a proprietary limited company to start with.
Yeah, it's fair enough to say that. Oh, it's not really fair enough to say. If once you've done your apprenticeship, well, there's business courses out there that teach you this, but once guys start their apprenticeship, they're pretty much into it. They want to start earning some money and getting some time back because they've had 2 years of whatever the apprentice wages is, so they want to start making some money for their family. To tell them to take time out and do a business course and try and they may not even cover this stuff in the business course is a big ask. So you're basically solving a lot of questions, solving a lot of problems for these guys by, one, putting a forum for where they can all join in and they can start asking questions, start sharing information. And two, you're curating this, so the quality of information that they're getting on this forum is usable data and is genuinely helpful. And the third thing is that you then have that next level where you're offering specific information relevant to their situation, whether it be starting the business or as they want to grow the business and go to the next level, because effectively you've been there. So, yeah, it's powerful stuff. So this is essentially the whole thing behind Tradie HQ.
Yeah. So that was that's. So all this was going on and, you know, I started to realise that there's a massive gap between sort of doing your and the irony of all this is, like, as an electrical contractor, and obviously I use that as an example because that's what I know and that's what the one-man band Spark is, but the Perth or the WA electrical contractors course, it's a two-week course and it has the biggest element of business in it comparable to anywhere else in the country.
Right.
However, and this is nothing against the guys who I know who will probably listen to this that are lecturers for electrical contractors courses, but it's sometimes it's delivered by people who have never owned a business, so they don't necessarily have the context or the real world experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to be honest, when I did it, it was the end of the course as well. So, you know, the guys have, they're over it. Like they're there. They just want to get out and start doing work.
Yeah.
They don't want to, they're like, oh, yeah, all right. And all they'll do is retain enough knowledge to get them through that final part. Then they go, right, see you later. They'll go get the sole trader, start as a sole trader, ABN, and off they go.
Yeah.
So it was the genesis of, or the starting for Tradie HQ. And it sort of came about, previously I'd said to Marta, my wife, that I wanted to start a gym.
Sweet.
Because good idea. And this would have been probably before I even was aware of you guys. But I had other mates. So I've got, you know, Glenn Azar, and then I've got Ian Bone and a few other mates from the army who have started good gyms.
Yeah.
And I've seen this community that they've built and, you know, this following of people. And I always sort of was in awe of it. And I thought, well, that's awesome. You know, I wouldn't mind being a part of something like that. And my side was going to be very similar to Glenn's model in terms of being adventure-based, you know, with it and being able to facilitate those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But Marta's like, no, you don't really want to own a gym, do you? And I'd spoken to a few other people and they're like, nah, well, you know, all right, no, I don't really want to own a gym, but I do like this community idea.
Yeah.
And then so one day or 1 week, Marta and I were over in Melbourne for a football trip and I was walking around Melbourne while she was shopping and I walked past a light industrial area and I walked down a street and the first thing I saw was a heap of motorbikes out the front. And they weren't Harleys, they were like, you know, cafe racer sort of obviously modified motorbikes. And as I walked past the roller door, there was a heap of people inside there, like all working on bikes and stuff. And I was like, it just piqued my interest. And as I walked past it, I'll go have another look. And I walked back and had another look. And one of the guys saw me walk backwards and forwards twice. And he's like, oh, you all right, mate? And I'm like, oh, yeah, nah, sorry, mate. I said, I just thought I'd have a look at what's going on. It's just, you know, he goes, oh, this is custom commune. I said, all right, what's custom commune? I'm not from Melbourne. He goes, oh, it's a shared workshop that, you know, we're all a part of and we've all got a common interest for, you know, modifying bikes. And I stayed there for about an hour and he ran me through the whole thing and I was just like blown away by the fact that, you know, all these guys, this was their common interest and they'd managed to make a workshop out of it. And the guy who ran it, Jimmy Good, and still does, I reached out to him and he gave me a little bit of info. But the next morning, I was Marta and I were at breakfast, and I sort of, and I'd been thinking about it overnight, and I said, "Oh, you know what? There's something missing between, you know, if a tradie wants to work, do like build their business, there's a big gap between working out of home and getting your own workshop. And, you know, a workshop is a fairly large determining factor or space to work, I should say, as to what jobs you can take on. And I thought about myself when I was doing the middle variation of the BHP billet and sign in the city. That when I did that, I needed space to have 28 steel enclosures, you know, and the actual letters themselves to be able to pre-wire them. And it wasn't a necessarily overly technical job, but you just needed the space. And for me, the boys, my boys were young then, they were probably only 2 or 3. And so I couldn't work all hours of the night at home. And so as we sat there at breakfast, I sort of said to her, well, you know, what if we did a co-working space for tradies? And she didn't straight away shoot that down. So I thought, okay, I'm under something here.
It's funny how they litmus test the most ideas. Yeah. You've got to have one.
Yeah, so that was that. And she said, well, what do you think, what would that look like? And I went through and said, you know, it'll be a workshop for a start, you know, so there'll be space there. There'll be, you know, and we'll have ultimately a co-working space, as you'd see in St. George's Terrace, you know, with a hot desk arrangements, meeting rooms, a sort of a kitchen that people can sort of congregate around, plus a training room and that sort of thing. But on top of that, we would have a workshop, and in that workshop would be a gym. So yeah, there's, here you know, go. Tick that Bang. Off as well. Yeah, so that was it. And you know, initially, the way I saw that, the biggest sort of hook or draw card for it was going to be the workshop, the fact that it would be a 24/7 facility for gold members, and it would be a place that they could go to when it suited them. So if you had a young family like I did, you could put the kids down at 8 o'clock at night, say goodbye to the missus and go and work, you know, because sometimes you've just got to work whenever you can.
Yeah.
Again, harking back to that mentality of, well, we've just got to get this job done.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to turn my nose up at having to work till midnight. Yeah. Right? That is the job.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as we've sort of progressed and developed the idea more, I started to realise that in line with what the Facebook group does for electricians, the thing that Tradie HQ needs to do for tradies in general is provide that opportunity for mentorship and guidance in order to make sure they don't make the mistakes that we've all made. And I spoke last night in front of the Stirling Business Association about Tradie HQ, and I said to them, you know, like, all of this stuff is basically my mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, I've done that. I started as a sole trader, only 3 years down the track having to change it to a proprietary limited company. And the irony of it all is that, you know, and I was the same, I just wanted the path of least resistance to get my ABN to start doing this job that I had lined up. Had I spent the time back then to set it up properly, you know, I wouldn't have had to do this 3 years in the future. And the thing about doing it 3 years in the future is, A, my time is worth more, I've got less of it. And, you know, the actual time it takes you to restructure your business and subsequently change all of your accounts, your insurance, as an electrician, change your registration with energy safety, you think, fuck, like,
yeah,
what would have taken me an extra 2 hours and probably $3,000, yep, you know, back at the start, yep, was, I would have paid that would have been twice
time,
over.
Time and money well spent.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay. Yeah, so when's it open?
So we have finally, I mean, we had our fair share of experiences in trying to find a property, and obviously COVID in between and that sort of stuff. So now we've got a property at 307 Selby Street in Osborne Park, and we get the keys for that on the 1st of August. Now, in terms of the opening time, I've given myself a worst case scenario of 60 days from getting the keys, but there will be a stage in there where, you know, we've got offices, people will be able to take on those offices before then. So I've got a list of interested people that once I get the keys, then I'll have an event there one evening before we do anything, just so people can get a feel for the space, get all our interested parties, all of our sponsors in there, and then from there,
go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, good. Well, so it's exciting times. So what is this, because obviously you've gone through a number of different initiatives. Is there more on the table? Is there more on the head? Or what's after this? What's after Tradie HQ?
So, no. I mean, there is. It's all going to be tied around Tradie HQ. Yeah, right. So I've got some pretty some pretty lofty ambitions in terms of what we're going to be able to provide for our member base and the broader sort of trade-based business community.
Yeah.
We want Osborne Park is going to be the flagship branch. We want to have three metropolitan facilities, north, Osborne Park, and then south.
Yeah.
And the idea being is that, you know, again with the Facebook group, the guys are doing work from Lancelin to Mandurah. So if they are in, you know, if they need to stop somewhere on the way, or if they need to have a meeting somewhere that's convenient, then I want to have that network of facilities so they can just drop in, quickly use a bench grinder or something, you know. But also broaden that network to encompass, you know, more of a Perth-based metro or WA-wide, really. Because I don't see Tradie HQ as being something like a gym in terms of people being a member there for, you know, 10 years. Not a gold member. I should qualify that by saying not a gold member. So I'll just explain the tiers of membership, I suppose. So there's going to be a casual member, which is sort of makes them a part of the business network, you know, so they'll get invites to all of their functions and that sort of stuff. They will also be able to use the facility on a pay-as-you-go basis. So during staffed business hours, they can come in and use it if they want to for a fee. Up from there, there's a gold tradie. So they'll have full 24/7 access to the facility plus an allotment of hours for training and meeting rooms per month. Up from there, there is the shared offices. So we'll have offices that will have four tables inside there or four desks, and the four occupants of that office will have keys, so then they can lock it up at the end of the day, leave stuff there and that sort of thing. And then the top tier, or, you know, the one up from there, is the resident tradie. So that's someone who's got a dedicated office. They might have a small team, for instance, and then they can use that as their lock-up office.
Right, right.
So, but, you know, like I say, I don't necessarily think people would be the gold tradie in a perfect world, I would see them being there for, say, 3 years. In that 3 years, I want them to develop their business to the point where they've got confidence in their business and their work coming in to get a place of their own. Or they might go, oh, you know what, it's not worth, I'm not cut out for this, I don't want to do it anymore. And hopefully they've met someone there that they can just go and work for,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
But basically it's a term that's used, but I've started calling it more of a business incubator, where guys come in, they get the knowledge they need, and then they move on, sort of thing.
Yep.
But I want to retain those guys, the success stories and the failures, you know, well, not failures, you know, but the guys who decided they don't want to run their own business, but retain them as social members. So in the event that we get a new guy coming through who's starting a plumbing business, for instance, we can say, oh, we've got Jono, you know, he's a success story of Tradie HQ.
Yep.
Jono, would you mind taking this guy under your wing and just sort of guiding him through it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I guess.
And having that mentorship.
Once you get it open, you'll also see some opportunities or avenues, you know, which weren't apparent when you started, but organically you'll gravitate that way, or you'll see this is a gap that needs to be filled. And I guess that's the same for everyone else as far as a business incubator, to go in there and I don't know this environment, I don't know, I'm just starting out in this process, and more of it will become apparent, but you've got more of a group to bounce things off in terms of making sure it's efficiently done or done effectively.
Yeah, that's it. And that's, you're exactly right with the idea about remaining flexible. And that's another a big thing about, well, it harks back to leadership, you know, whereby pick a path, but don't be afraid to make judgments along the way and go, oh, hang on, this isn't working, let's just tweak it a bit, pivot and go this way. Yeah. And I heard something the other day about, someone was talking about pivot, and when you consider like a netball player, when they pivot, you know, they don't just turn and go somewhere else. They sort of keep one foot planted but just turn the other one, you know. So you still have the goal in mind, but you're just adjusting the way that you're going to get there. And with us, given that we are, I mean, it's definitely an Australian first initiative about in terms of having a co-working space specifically for tradies. And as far as I can tell, it's a world first thing. I haven't been able to find anything like it anywhere else. So to that end, we don't really have many benchmarks, you know, and we do have a unique client base in tradies.
Yep.
You know, they've got a fairly unique amount of requirements when it comes to business. There's a lot involved.
Yep.
You know, when I think about a young tradie starting out, and again, because they're just not told, you know, the guy who we were talking about who might have a $60,000 tax bill at the end of his first 18 months, there's a strong possibility he's also got over $50,000 worth of, you know, credit at suppliers, which is unsecured and very poorly vetted.
Yep.
So your exposure from a risk sense as a
it's pretty
as
big.
A, yeah, it's massive, yeah. And it can have like dire consequences. Yeah. You know? So it's another side of what I want to develop and push is the mental health side of things, you know, resilience. And, you know, you and I have spoken before about hopefully doing stuff in the future, you know, between the mill and Tradie HQ. And because I see great value in the guys doing something and having a bit of getting a bit of introspection and understanding sort of what they're capable of.
Yep.
And again, forming that bond.
And also having that tribe, that place where you can go, I guess, and you know, like you said, this is a product of the wins and the mistakes you've made in the past. And effectively, everyone who's going to go through this process is going to go through very similar trials and tribulations. So, I mean, you've got to pay those lessons forward, and this is a good forum to do it. And if you can do it in an environment where people go, okay, I'm not going to get judged, I can ask any question. And these people who have actually been there before, so their advice actually means something, carries some weight. It's a great thing. I mean, it's a different context, but the reason why we set up the gym. It's exactly the same thing. You know, you've got your tribe, you've got your family, you've got your village, and now it enables you a springboard into whatever it is you're going to do, but you could always come back to that.
Yeah.
So that's powerful.
And it should be fun, you know, like business should be fun. Yeah. Like I said, the guys who I've spoken to, that their idea of business was to, you know, more time, money and freedom and that sort of thing, like you should be able to achieve that, but you just need to understand what you need to do to get there, which has sort of formed the basis of one of the first offerings that I want to do. And I'm working with another company who run sort of business coaching and that. But basically, I want to develop a seminar where, you know, we'll get a room full of people, and in a perfect world, they would be people who 12 months from that point want to start their own trade-based business. So they might be working for someone else. And so we'll get a hold of them and say, right, guys, we'll work out what the average wage is in the room, and if it's 85 grand, we'll put that up on the board and say, right, if you want to replace that wage, this is what you're going to need to do.
Mm.
You know, these are the costs you can expect. This is your tax obligation, and distill it right down, all the way down to your charge out rate, you know, which obviously takes into consideration your break even, which is like a foreign word to half of the guys who start business. Yeah, yeah. And then your billable hours, which again is drastically different to the amount of time that you're sitting in your car, you know.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is, you know, when you do think to the future, if you did want to, in a couple of years' time, have guys work for you, you can only really expect, you know, between sometimes as low as 4, but on average about 6 billable hours per 8-hour day.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, if you're charging yourself out at X, you've developed this customer base, if all of a sudden you're employing someone and you're only as an electrician is an example, and you're only charging them out at $80 an hour, you're probably losing money on every job you send them to.
Yeah. Yeah, so you articulate this, you articulate these risks, and you basically illuminate a path which is, you know, as straight as you can make it, given the situation. And distills, like you said, distills a lot of the time wastage and a lot of the guesswork out of this whole process, which is great.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
And you know, that let's say that group of 20 people we get to run through this, let's say it splits them in half, you know, 10 go, fuck, I didn't realise that's what I have to do. Like, I'll go back to working for old mate. Yeah. Hopefully they go back being better employees. Yeah. Now they realise that what he's going through, the poor bastard. But then the other 10 will say, right, so if you're keen, you want to make it work, here are the people you need to speak to.
Yeah, great.
And so that's the other side of Tradie HQ. Aside from the actual member base of the tradies, we're also curating a list of associated professionals, whether it's accounting, legal, HR, and all the other things that go along with starting a business. But all of those associated professions that we're onboarding, I've either had direct relationships with, or they come recommended from people that I value the judgment of. And so the guys who are starting business don't have to, you know, pick the top of the Google search when they're looking for an accountant or something, only to find a year down the track that they had no idea about the intricacies of running a plumbing business, you know. And so these are all trials and tribulations that Marta and I have been through, you know, whether it's her business, which is hairdressing, or my business.
Mm.
You know, the last thing you want is to have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on a professional service only to realise that you would have been better off just trying to do it yourself and you know, bearing the consequences. And I guess when you think about that, in what I was saying with getting those guys, I think it's very similar to what you do with you guys in preparing people for selection. There must be some people who come to you guys and you're just like, look, mate, you've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is Tradie HQ for soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I can see the parallels. And I saw the parallels pretty early in terms of, well, you know, it's this whole thing about paying it forward. You know, you've got a lot of experience, and if we want the level to be increased the next time around, i.e. the next generation's level to be better contributors, more capable, smarter, fitter, faster, stronger, whatever it is, then we've got a part to play in that. And whether we were, whether we made major mistakes or whether we won everything, there's still something that we can contribute, and so we should. We've got to put ourselves out there and put it on the line for the sake of helping the next crew that come through. And in our case, it's about making the nation's capability better. But it doesn't matter whether, trade runs the world and trade runs our society. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what it is. If we can contribute in some way and be part of that village where we pass on the knowledge, then and we make sure that data or that content going out there is very usable and simplified so that people can actually enact on it and they can get it right, 90% of the time, then we've done something, we've contributed, we've paid it forward. So it's effectively the same thing, just in a different arena, effectively.
Yeah. No, and you touched on something there in terms of it being relatable. That's the other thing, like guys who want to start a trade-based business aren't MBAs. Mm. They haven't done that. They're not people who, if you start talking, proprietary business level acronyms and everything, they're not going to get it. They literally need it. And again, that's the part of the reason why I want to do this seminar is to break it down and just explain, in terms that are relatable as a tradie, to say, well, mate, think about it this way. Why would you, as someone who wants to charge themselves out at, XXX dollars, try and do something you're no good at when you can pay someone XX dollars to do it, do it?
Yeah, exactly right. And I think it also makes it simple to hear it simplified in everyday language, because you can think it just sounds too hard. Well, actually, it's much simpler if you do it this way.
Mm.
So yeah, it's great stuff. It's good stuff. And it's also, I think it's very common that guys who leave the military, they understand this track, because we spend a lot of time giving back to the Army in terms of getting our instructor certificates or instructor's qualifications and teaching the skill sets that we'd learnt, experienced and executed, then pay it back to the next generation. And every time that we go through that process, we are trying to improve the process. So the lessons learned from my experience, I'm going to try and put it into this training package. When I pass it forward, whether it be offline or during class, I'm giving that information from an experience perspective.
Mm.
And that's highly usable. The capability in any arena is greatly enhanced by those practitioners or the exponents of that sport, profession, craft, whatever it is, taking those lessons learned and paying them forward. And that's the way it should work. That's how we make society better. That's how we make our workplace better. That's why we make the nation's capability better, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. And achieving those outcomes are so much it's so much more effective when, it's not just one person trying to deliver that. You it's the village. It's drawing on that wealth of knowledge of a collection of people, all with different sort of backgrounds and specialities, and putting them in front of the people that need to know that information, because they're, again, I could sit down and read a book on something and then tell someone what I'd read, but I don't have the real world experience in that particular subject, so it's not going to come across with a great deal of authority. Mm. And if any questions get asked, I'm going to look a bit silly as well.
Or even authenticity, So yeah, that's it's good stuff. It's very commendable stuff. And from my perspective, mate, seeing you come and do the Havoc camp, and seeing the crew that you had coming through with you and doing it, and the efforts you put into it, and even when one of the guys wanted to pull out within 2 hours, and between us and you guys keeping him on, I think it's one of the best things. I actually ran into him the other day.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. He goes, "Do you remember me?" Okay. No. Why was that? Well, you kept me on this damn course. I wanted to pull off within half an hour. Oh, yeah, I remember you now.
That's funny. That's good.
But he was thankful for the experience, and he's glad he stuck with it. So
yeah.
That makes me very happy.
Yeah. It is, and that's I knew straight away from the moment he turned up late and went through it all, that he was going to get the most out of that activity, and that's why I wanted to make sure that we kept him on there. And obviously I knew that you guys would. But I thought back to my UATL days in running adventurous training, and the ones who were shit scared were the ones who at the end of it would always come up to us as the leaders and go, "Fuck, thanks, man. I got so much out of that. I really didn't want to abseil that. I didn't want to, do that jump or whatever, but I'm glad that I did."
Yeah.
And,
Yeah. It's that background, that experience of actually seeing you teach someone and they get so much out of it. It's really rewarding. And I think that for me, and I think more than likely for you, is that is to have that feeling going forward, no matter where, what arena you're playing in, to be able to, well, change someone's life or change someone's perspective is very, very rewarding. So, I mean, all we're trying to do is actually get our own dopamine release by...
It's a bit selfish.
A little bit selfish, but, you know, we are paying it forward still at the same time, but yeah. Very, very worthy.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, obviously that's a motivator for us too, you know.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, when I've tried to apply my own thoughts and everything about what we're doing with Tradie HQ, my genuine purpose for it is to make sure that if people want to start their own business, that they do it with the best possible chance of success, you know. And I want people to make a decision, not only for them personally, but also for the benefit of the industry. I want them to make a decision of like, yeah, I want to do it, I want to do it properly, or, you know what, I don't want to do it half-cocked. You know, if, you know, at the end of the day, if I go back and sort of apply myself as an employee, I've got more chance of achieving what I want. You know, I don't need to go out on my own,
take that risk,
because that's what mates have done. That's what Jono did, and he's got a fucking brand new Hilux. You know, like
yeah. It's always the clincher, isn't it?
Yeah. So yeah, when I think about it, like my intention comes from a good place, and that is to help people and to build it along the way. You know, and again, a little bit of selfishness comes into it because, you know, along with that, I want to do all the things that I'm going to try and make sure the guys will be able to do, like, you know, come and do more stuff with you guys, work with Glenn and take people away on trips for personal development that they might not have ever considered doing, you know, whether that's Kokoda or Basecamp or, you know, all these other things that people probably think are outside of the realm of what they can do and just don't understand the benefit that they would get from doing it.
Yeah, a lot of people be asking, oh, why would you want to do that? But, yeah, they've got to see the outcome. You've got to somehow describe the outcome so they see the clear path. Oh, if I do this, oh, that's the outcome. Okay, I get it. I want to do it.
Yeah, and it's all relatable back to business.
Yeah.
Now, business is hard. You know, there's times when you're like, well, why am I even doing this? You know, but that's where you've got to remind yourself of what your goals are and the fact that you need to forego or you need to undergo this sort of temporary hardship for the sake of achieving those goals.
That delayed gratification.
Delayed gratification, that's it.
Yeah. Well, mate, I'm quickly running, not necessarily out of time, but out of questions.
Yeah.
But no, it's been very, very interesting, and thanks for giving me a chance to turn the tables on you. Like, I must admit, the first time I did a podcast, I was actually really, really nervous. But I'm getting a little bit more comfortable with it. But I still don't think I'll make a very good interviewer. But thanks for the opportunity.
No, no worries, mate. Thank you. And I appreciate it. I appreciate the offer back when we did that podcast, and appreciate this being our sort of third time in front of the mics together, and I'm sure there'll be plenty more. So, yeah, appreciate it, mate.
Anytime. Good Thanks, on. Dan.
Take care. All right.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tradie HQ podcast. For more information, head to tradiehqwa.com.au and follow us on Facebook at the Tradie HQ podcast group. Have a great day.